You're listening to Las Vegas Weekly Radio Mag on KUNV 91.5. I'm Steve Freese, columnist for the Las Vegas Weekly. And I'm talking with Chuck Muth. He's the president of Citizen Outreach and a former executive director of the Nevada Republican Party. He also issues a pretty much daily missive called Muth's Truth, which is his polling mix on the political issues of the day. And Terry Wilty is a local travel agent. His travel agency is called A Answer on Travel, and he is a board member of the Lambda Business and Professional Association. We're talking today because my column this week deals with this question of whether Nevada and Las Vegas have already missed the boat on cashing in on legal gay marriage. This comes up because on Friday, the New York State Senate passed the law that would permit same-sex marriage in New York, making New York the largest state by far and doubling the number of Americans in this country who are living in a state where same-sex marriage is fully legal and recognized. And it happened in an interesting way. One of the more peculiar parts is the fact that this was the first time a Republican-led house of any state legislature passed gay marriage. So kind of a revolution in that respect. And the same day that this happened, Chuck put out his Muth's Truth, his daily newsletter on email. And in it, he told his readers, his subscribers, that they won't like hearing this, but gay marriage is coming. It's inevitable. It's only a matter of time, I'm quoting. It can and will be delayed, but it will not be stopped. And so basically he's saying that the conservatives should get on board, not be on the wrong side of history, and while we're at it, perhaps cash in. First of all, I wanted to ask Chuck, did the people who read this email letter, did they not like it?
Oh, I'm sure a number of them didn't like it. There are some, you know, in the conservative movement, there are some people who are adamantly, viscerally opposed to gay marriage. They never like to hear it when I say it. Of course, I've been active and interested in this issue since 2002. I actually testified against the federal marriage amendment before the United States Senate in 2003, which was very, very unusual and uncomfortable because all the Republicans were on the other side of the issue. And as a conservative, I got Dick Durbin and Ted Kennedy and Russ Feingold on my side. That was talk about strange bedfellows in politics. Whenever this issue is brought up, there are always conservatives, social conservatives particularly, who are viscerally opposed to the notion of gay marriage. But I've seen, over the past 7-8 years I've been involved in the issue, the opposition to it has shrunk, and there's still some visceral, very loud voices against it. But a lot of the opposition is more muted now. And I think it is. It's just a matter of time before people will, and it's going to be a long time, it's not going to happen tomorrow, where people will accept gay marriages the way black and white marriages are accepted today, even though there are still some racists in this country who still can't come to grips with black-white marriage. But overall, I think the country's going to move in that direction.
So in Nevada, do you think that it is politically risky for a Republican to support same-sex marriage?
Sure. Absolutely. It's still risky because Republican primaries are dominated by conservatives primarily. And in a lot of the communities, a lot of the districts, it's a very strong social conservative bent in those Republican primaries. So, yeah, depending on the district and the Republican, it's still very risky politically to come out and say that.
Now, you know the process probably a lot better than I do. But because this state passed a voter-approved referendum that defines in the state constitution marriages between a man and a woman, and theoretically does not allow the legislature to do anything else, even though the domestic partner law pretty much circumvented that. Because of that, though, the process to undo that would be what? And how long? I mean, if no court got involved, if there was no court intervention at all, and it was just up to the legislature, and we are starting today, how long would it take before marriage could be legal for everybody in Nevada?
Well, the ban on same-sex marriage in Nevada is a constitutional amendment. Nevada, I believe, is the only state in the country that requires that a constitutional amendment be passed not once, but twice by voters. So to undo that, to amend the Constitution, to undo it, would require two successive votes by the voters. So it's a very difficult process to amend the Constitution.
So in this particular case, the odds are much better for gay people in Nevada that perhaps a federal court will step in and say that amendment is unconstitutional.
That could happen. You know, we'll watch and see what happens in California, with question eight there. But I've said this all along, even if you don't, and originally I've evolved a little bit on this issue. Originally, I was a state's rights person. Let each state decide whether or not you allow gay marriages, but don't prohibit the states from doing that through the federal marriage amendment. But the more you read the Supreme Court, I mean, as these cases work their way up, if you read the language of the Loving decision, Loving versus Virginia.
This is the 1969 decision?
68-69.
That legalized interracial marriage?
Interracial marriage. It's very clear in the Supreme Court decision, they declared that marriage was a right. Well, if marriage is a right, and the fact of the matter is, benefits from the federal government are given to married couples that are reserved from couples who aren't married. So you've got the equal protection issue to deal with, plus the fact that the court has already once before ruled that marriage is a right. And we all know the courts are very, very hesitant to overturn a previous court's decision. I think it's going to be very difficult for the Supreme Court, even the conservative makeup of the Supreme Court, it's going to be very difficult for them not to make it the law of the land nationally.
So that our listeners understand, there's also a couple of permutations here. There are cases that are wending their way up to the Supreme Court. It is entirely possible that a quirk could develop in which the Ninth District Court of Appeals strikes down Prop 8, which would effectively strike down any amendments in the states underneath the Ninth District, which includes Nevada, but not make it legal across the country. So there is actually this like weird way that Nevada could become a gay marriage rights state without doing anything and without the Supreme Court making it legal across the land. That's one possibility. Another possibility is the Supreme Court will take it up and invalidate it or enforce the idea that every state has their own decision. I want to turn to Terry Wilson, because I want to hear from you. Do you hear from your clients, gay people who travel to Las Vegas, that, first of all, they may or may not know what the law is here. They may not know whether or not they can get married here or not. But because marriage is, weddings are a big industry in Nevada and Las Vegas, do you believe that there is a bounty to be had? Is there a bonanza to be had if Nevada were to pass or either pass it or have it forced on us that marriage is legal here?
Actually, the situation now is, as you suggested in your opening, that we're possibly a little beyond the cutting edge of legalized gay marriage. Most of the clients have fundamentally assumed that Nevada, because of our reputation with divorce, with easy weddings, et cetera, and the celebrities, that, yeah, it would be legal here. They don't really pay necessary good attention
sure.
to what's going on. It is a situation where very definitely after California had its brief legal marriage situation.
Before Prop 8.
Yeah, before Prop 8. We had a fair amount of civil union celebrations coming into the chapels here in Las Vegas that would accept that. And there were a number of them, and there were a couple that were pretty much dedicated to the LGBT market.
Mm-hmm.
After California provided the temporary service, that dropped off dramatically. And then, unfortunately, it does not seem to have picked up that much after Prop 8 went through
In 2008.
In 2008. So right now, it's sort of a limbo status, of course, obviously. People still come for the celebration. They come for the theme, the Elvis, the whatever kind of an experience as a celebration of togetherness. But it's far less than it was. Part of that, of course, may be the economy.
Well, there could be the economy. It's also legally insignificant wherever
right.
they're from.
Exactly.
And the other question I have is interesting and separate from that. When it was legal in California, was there much of a market for honeymoons or bachelor parties or that kind of stuff that goes on around a typical wedding?
very little that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Because California, of course, is also a honeymoon destination.
Sure.
The beaches of California, West Hollywood, San Francisco, particularly for the LGBT community. So no, I did not see much spinoff, except some of the Californians who just considered Vegas a vacation and or honeymoon destination would come up here. But as far as other people really taking advantage of it or a significant jump, no.
Chuck, when in your note, in this email, you kind of argued that. You argued that there was a business angle here. And I wonder, do you think that whether or not it's real is up for us to kind of debate, but do you think that that some folks who are opposed to gay marriage can be persuaded on economic grounds?
No. The ones who are adamantly opposed to it are not going to be changed by an economic argument. Where I think the difference could be made are folks who are not fundamentally and religiously opposed to gay marriage may take a look at the economic potential and then say that it might be worthwhile to pursue the possibility of overturning it, that it might be worth the money to the gaming industry to try to make Las Vegas more hospitable and open and welcome to the gay community coming in for marriages. And there's two different types of marriages too, by the way. Not types, but the way you get married. There's one where you get married in one city and then you fly somewhere else for the honeymoon.
Sure.
And then there's destination where, like I got married, I flew to Hawaii and we had the wedding and the honeymoon in Hawaii. There's that combination. Now, I think there was a report last week that showed that, was it 1 in 10 couples in California are now same-sex households? And California is a huge venue. And as you said, and as Terry said, people want to come to Las Vegas just because it's Las Vegas. They come for all kinds of reasons.
Right.
My only suggestion is if we roll out the welcome mat, we're going to pick up some extra business. And in this economy, considering how badly Las Vegas has been hurt, considering that we're not going to get automobile manufacturing plants here, we're not going to get high-tech, Silicon Valley type of businesses here anytime soon, entertainment is what we do. And we should be, as open as possible to bringing in new tourism, new business that really is what Vegas is supposed to be all about anyway.
Talk to me about the politics here, because like I said, the New York State Senate is a Republican body that passed this. And there are a number of significant voices out there. Ken Melman, who ran, I believe, George Bush's campaign, is now out of the closet and promoting gay marriage. Dick Cheney, the vice president, whose daughter is a lesbian, is certainly promoting it. There are a lot of voices in the Republican Party that are saying exactly what you said, which is, this is coming and it's really none of the government's business. And that's what some people believe to be a principled conservative stance. Does it frustrate you a little bit that there is a terrific opportunity here, particularly because a lot of gay people are very disappointed that President Obama has not come all the way to their side? Do you feel like there's you're missing an opportunity to grab gay voters for a generation? I mean, if there are Republicans who stand up, because the numbers do show that I believe in 2008 I'm gonna mess it up, but I think it was something in the neighborhood of 75% of gay people voted for Democrats, and in 2010 it was like 65. So I mean, it seems like a population that is in play, that there are a lot of gay people who want marriage, they want civil rights. But they're also often conservative, maybe have more money.
Sure. There's a difference between New York and Nevada in that New York Republicans are different from Nevada Republicans. They're more liberal. That's that Northeast liberal type of Republican.
They define the Rockefeller
They are, exactly. Nevada is more of a libertarian Republican to a certain extent. So I don't think it's going to be as hard of a threshold to go from New York to Nevada as it would be to go from New York to Iowa or Arkansas or Nebraska and that sort of thing. So I think there's more room to grow here, but we're not quite is the way a New York Republican is. So it's a little bit frustrating, but Nevada having that libertarian streak, which has been clouded a little bit with a lot of the influx of people from other states that have moved here. It's not quite as libertarian in Las Vegas as it is around the rest of the state. But there's also still, again, there's that strong social conservative element, especially within the LDS population, that just absolutely, opposes this. And it was the Mormon Church who really was a driving force behind the gay marriage ban in the first place.
Well, it's been a terrific discussion. Thank you both for joining me here. Again, you can read my column about all this in Las Vegas Weekly. quickly. And thanks a lot, guys, for your time.
We're back with more of Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Sarah Feldberg, editor of Las Vegas Weekly, and today I'm joined by Apollo Robbins, the Gentleman Thief. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you call yourself the Gentleman Thief. Where did that name come from?
I found if I said thief, I generally scared people, so if I add gentleman, it makes it a little bit of a sugar to help the medicine go down.
But do you consider yourself a thief?
No. I have the knowledge of a thief, but most of my work is entertainment and consulting.
And tell me a little bit about that work. What kind of different ways do you use your knowledge?
It's anything related to deception, manipulation, persuasion. A lot of those all have negative connotations. I try to recreate and harvest information from those words, maybe show how manipulation can be turned into motivation. So that pulls me into from being an entertainer where I just steal things for entertainment, make people laugh, to consulting for law enforcement, to consulting on behavior for companies. And it's gone a lot of different directions that I didn't expect initially.
And I imagine there isn't a degree program in deception at your local university. How do you get into thievery as a career?
Well, I think this is the kind of thing you get kicked out of school for, actually. But as far as deception, there is training for deception detection, those types of things like people see on Lie to Me or Paul Ekman kind of studies. But a lot of what I do has evolved just from a career in entertainment where I was asked to come and consult for law enforcement on how thieves would work. And I told them that the context is a little bit different, so I need to be exposed to those thieves. So they opened up that I was able to work with halfway houses, with prisoners that were coming out that had special talents.
And what kind of talents are we talking about when it comes to a thief that you might learn something from or a con man?
Well, and I think thief I use as a general term. It could be a hacker. It could be a con man. Con men, in general, the idea is that con stands for confidence and their ability to make you feel confident in whatever ploy that they're pulling you into. So I like that idea of how they get you to bite into something. Now, some of them are exploitative, where they're taking advantage not of greed or those things, but maybe loneliness or other aspects, but human frailties that they try to prey on, I think, generally. But this has become kind of an interesting area that some of these things that I do have been discovered for the neuroscience community as being interesting tests for cognitive behavior. So they might be able to use these as a barometer to measure autism, for one.
Huh, interesting. And you've been part of some of these tests, is that right?
Mm-hmm. I've been in the fMRIs and the claustrophobic little tubes and shooting videos for them to play for their subject matters as well. And those have come out, so they've been published in scientific papers. And it's flattering because you see these ideas that you have that you think are theories. I had ideas that certain movements drew attention more than others, and they were able to test those in the labs and verify it. So now they're showing how that applies to other areas as far as like military maneuvers or marketing, the things that I wouldn't have thought of.
So even sort of the science behind theft and confidence schemes.
Yes. And that specifically would probably be the idea, is the science. Because I think it's easy to make theories and speculations about why things work. But for me, I have an opportunity and access to an interesting spectrum of people and expertise, so I can take that and transfer it into something that hasn't been done before, hopefully.
Wow, very interesting. Now, I can remember personally the first time I sort of understood what theft was. And it was when I think I was about 8 years old and my dad's car was stolen out of our driveway one night, and the cops were there in the morning and they were questioning me if I had any friends that my parents didn't know and all sorts of things. And I kind of understood, wow, someone just took something. When did you kind of discover your interest in theft and in these kind of, in this career line?
I have two half-brothers, and they had met my father and introduced him to their mother. But the way they met my father was unusual in that they were planning to rob him. And then they found out that he was blind and he couldn't see. They felt sorry for him, so they introduced him to their mother. He turned out to be a very conservative minister, and it became a very interesting dynamic in that household. So I grew up born with my brothers moving into more elaborate crime, and my father raised me in private schools. So it became a very interesting area because we always want to have our older brothers as a role model, but obviously that's different than what my father taught. So I had to have kind of an independent area That's why for me later on as a teen, I started studying sleight of hand and magic, and I found that that was an honest area to use deception. And it was kind of either a choice of going that way or maybe into politics. So I tried to choose the more honest of the two.
Probably a good decision. And you still sort of walk that line between deception for negative purposes and for actually helping in science and study. And you have a community that really straddles that line. Tell me a little bit about your sort of group of friends, and you have a sort of social network brain trust that you've created.
Yes. Well, as part of this group, I met some interesting guys over the 16 years I've been here in Las Vegas. And some of those were, one of them was a hacker who hacked into NORAD. His name was Kevin Mitnick. He was a rather prominent hacker who now is a consultant and speaks for companies and tests their security systems. Another friend of mine worked for the Dunes Casino as a bust-out dealer back in the good old days when the mob ran the room, the poker room. And then he turned around and started cheating slot machines and doing heists. And he's now, as of December, doing 5 years in prison for that, 1 to 5 years. And so these guys, originally I had this idea of bringing us all together and then also bringing in the other side of law enforcement. The difficulty was that law enforcement's not supposed to interact or to fraternize with felons.
Sure.
So I kind of became that conduit, and now I have a clean background. I have no felonies, no crimes. So I can harvest knowledge from the guys and share it. But also I try to find in the law enforcement or the government agencies or federal agents, people with unusual expertise like deception detection, polygraph operators, or organized commercial crimes. And then I'll bring them in and we'll do talks together. We'll do presentations for conferences and we'll do training.
And what are some of the interesting ways that law enforcement is trying to catch people like some of your friends?
Mm-hmm. Well, law enforcement is being diversified in such a wide spectrum that they haven't had to deal with before, because now there used to be something called bunco squads that was very much sectioned off for going after confidence crimes and these types of areas. And now that has some of those resources have been pulled off towards Homeland Security, and they have all this external focus of what is going to threaten our country. So they have a harder time with these types of crimes now than they used to. So, and the crimes have moved in that, like, there used to be these big cons or short cons, the difference of those, like you'd see in the movie The Sting.
Classic. Love that movie.
Exactly. Well, and that idea of the big store and the Gandolf brothers and pulling that con together, it still happens to a degree, but now it's a little bit more accessible. You don't have to, quote unquote, put someone on the send and make them go liquidate all their assets and come back and take their money months later. Now it's so much easier to take someone's money in a day because of access to their bank accounts, their information. So it's much more fast. So you were asking me earlier about these groups like the East European hackers in those communities. Mm-hmm. Those are being recruited as hired guns for a lot of different organized crime groups.
It's kind of a scary world out there. I mean,
it is.
Especially with internet crime and identity theft and just the ease with which personal funds might be accessed online.
And it's really the difference between the bank. It's kind of on the bank's shoulders for a lot of that, because the access to that information, it's already been spilt. The milk has been spilt. It's out there. If I want to find your social security number, it would probably take me about an hour.
An hour, really?
For me, because I'd have to call someone to get it. But the people that I know can look it up instantly and have it. But that's information is out there. It's available. And right now, just putting ATM credit card skimmers into gas station pumps or put them into point of sale devices, all of those are being done here, Vegas, Southern California, at a rapid pace. So you'll get your credit card data skimmed, may have already had it skimmed or compromised. And then the bank will issue a notice saying, we notice your account has been compromised. And that's the difference between using debit cards versus credit cards and those kind of things.
So do you deal only in cash because you know all this stuff? Are you seeing threats everywhere?
No, I am pretty much the same as everyone else. I'll maybe set up my bank accounts a little bit differently, and then I'll have all my resources in a different account that doesn't have a debit card or anything that goes into it. And then I'll transfer money across to an account that has that access. So I have a layer of protection first, but that's just for debit card, and then there's credit cards are a separate issue.
And you've worked on the TV show Leverage for a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. What do you do for them?
I'm their technical advisor on cons. So work with writers to develop different types of cons, educate them on the different cultures that are inside the criminal world that are active now, the ones that used to be, and kind of give them some plot twists, and sometimes come in and train the actors how to do the steals, as far as like if it's a pickpocket or a sting, something you'd see like in Ocean's 11. But it's amazing. You give a writer a kernel of an idea, what they can do with it and how they can turn it around. It's fascinating to watch.
Oh, sure. It sounds a little bit like criminal anthropology in a certain way, kind of the study mm-hmm. of cultures within this community.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite episode or a favorite con that's come out of your technical direction?
They brought me in to appear on one, so obviously I enjoyed that process. I played a character called Apollo Fields, which was kind of an international cat burglar thief character. And that was in an episode. The main leader of the team on their show is Timothy Hutton. And Timothy Hutton's team, we had another team go up against them with an all-star cast that would, the gentleman who used to play Wesley Crusher mm-hmm. on Star Trek The New Generation played our hacker, and I played the thief, and we had a group that went team-to-team episode that was rather funny. The show's kind of tongue-in-cheek, a little bit like A-Team mixed with Mission Impossible.
Sure. Very cool. And you've also been working on a documentary, is that right, for National Geographic?
Yes. Well, actually, since January, I've shot two documentaries. Both of them are kind of this interesting behavioral cognitive space of where neuroscience and deception and behaviors are kind of going. They're trying to explain what happens in your mind when you're being deceived through your perceptions, through your attention. So National Geographic's big project, working title is called BrainWorks. It comes out in September. And we did several perception tests that will fool the viewers at home. And then several other ones that we just show them us fooling other people. And Copperfield is one of the hosts on that. I host a portion of it as well. And we go through and show these different experiments here in Vegas. It will be a pretty prominent function that they'll have a DVD, a website, and a book dedicated to it, like their Planet Earth and some of their other big specials.
Sounds great. And you talked a little bit about what it feels like to be deceived. What about for the person who's doing the deceiving? Data can be so easily found these days. What stops everyone from going out and stealing credit card numbers and using them?
Dan O'Reilly is a behavioral economist who wrote a book called Predictably Irrational, and he has some interesting studies on that. The difference between people will steal a beer bottle out of a box that says private property inside of a refrigerator, but they won't take anything of item of cash. It's kind of that idea of how they view themselves. If I took the cash, I'm a thief. If I take the beer, I'm not a thief.
Just thirsty.
So is it? Yes, just thirsty. So it's the same type of thing as with the credit cards. You're disconnected. It's a little bit easier to rationalize why you're stealing from someone because you don't have the face, you don't have the victim. So the larger face-to-face crimes that becomes, the more antisocial you have to be. And the more you have to be able to rationalize why you're stealing from this person. Are they part of the institution? Like my friend who's the card cheat, he views the casinos as a big establishment, that he's a Robin Hood going against them. So each person has their own way of viewing that. And for me, that's a fascinating area too, to understand that basically your criminal limit of how much you would step over that line is based on how much you can rationalize.
Wow, fascinating. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, but thank you so much for joining me.
It was my pleasure.
And you can read more about Apollo and about the new face of crime in Las Vegas this week at lasvegasweekly.com and in this week's issue. And thank you to all of our guests today and to our producer, Steven Zeller. This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV.